they're doing it slowly and subtly, but every night somewhere in the world, someone gets home and finds musical chairs. There's one less parking space where they live. How can you stop driving if there's nowhere to park? You can't stop your car. So they're going to have to go around and stay in a holding pattern. Every year, there's just going to be more and more. These poor people are going to be stuck. Like your man in that movie Terminal with Tom Hanks. He got stuck in an airport for years. Some problem with his passport. These poor bastards, they can't find a parking space because they're being literally removed from under their feet while they were driving. So they can never stop. They have to keep driving round and round in circles. And they're going to get the blame for there being still traffic. They're trying to stop. There's nowhere to park. He took their parking places. What in the name of Christ is wrong with you?
I know what you're thinking there. You're thinking, I don't agree with any of this at all. I don't agree. I don't agree with any of this. None of it whatsoever. Nothing in here that I can sign off on. There's nothing I can go, oh no, yeah, this is okay. This is acceptable. This represents my views or represents new views that I'm prepared to adopt or at least not protest to the point of demanding this fella's arrest or demanding he be removed from the internet or whatever it is. Well, what's bothering you? Spill it out. Do you clearly have some problem with me? You have some issue with me. Spill it out. Tell me. Is it the smell? Is that it? I appreciate there is a smell off me at the moment. I did clean out the fridge earlier and something spilled on me from somewhere, some sort of liquid. It was all in the process of cleaning. I wasn't making the world a less clean place. I was doing quite the opposite. And whatever it is on my t-shirt now, but that will be dealt with later. And there's nobody here at the moment. You can't smell it, so there's no reason it should bother you. So stop letting it bother you. If you're worrying about the fact that there's a smell off me now that you didn't even know about, you're just looking for something to be offended by. You didn't even know about it until after I took you up on it. I called you out. I said, what is wrong with you? What is your objection to this program? And before you could even figure out what it was, because you didn't have anything, I told you what it was. And you decided, yes, that's right. That's what it is. It's the smell. That's why I knew there was something. It's the smell. I'll tell you what, sometimes he may be smelly, but at least he's right sometimes. And he's right about that. It is the smell. I have an issue with the smell of his t-shirt. Well, you can't smell that. I'm here alone in the house at the moment. My wife has gone out for the afternoon. Nobody here is experiencing, except maybe the cats. Now, I did hear a cat meowing in faux distress just now. But I can see them running around. There's not really any problem. They're not having any problem. And it's very unlikely that smell is affecting them. Because it's barely affecting me. So, and I tell you, I'd be quite sensitive to that stuff. If there was a smell on my t-shirt that was enough to bother you, a listener who doesn't even know about it, I think I'd be aware of that if it was big enough of a problem to annoy a cat in the next room. So don't you be worrying your pretty little head about that. You fucking weirdo. I have to take some responsibility for this because I've turned you into a weirdo. You're listening to this, you're listening to me talking all this nonsense and drivel. You're listening to me imagining that you've got some problem with a smell off my t-shirt from clearing out the fridge earlier. And I suppose that has to rub off on you in some way. The smell can't rub off on you, that's just not physically possible. But the attitude, yes, I take some responsibility for that, especially for imagining that that's happening to you. I take some responsibility for that. I've infused in you the idea of, the aforementioned thing. I've infused that in you. So I suppose that's a problem. Is that a problem? It probably is. Is it enough of a problem to use as a cold open
but not enough of a problem to not be contained within this 4.5 minute segment, which hopefully will be shorter after I cut out the mouth noises and things. But that remains to be seen. A tremendously exciting moment. It's Into Your Head, number 846. We've a lot to get on with today. Items that need to be attended to. Issues that need to be addressed. Topics. Oh, topics. We've got lots. Now, the more astute among you will have noticed something unusual here. I'm sipping from a glass. And that's unusual. As you know, if you listened at all attentively to this program over the last year, you'll know that when I go into record in the back room, I like to bring in the dregs of a bottle of Coke. Bottle of Coke that's nearly ready to be finished. And I like to do that because then I can just bring in the dregs of the bottle, drink it straight out of the bottle as my lubrication. And then when I'm finished, I can just stop by at the bottle place in the kitchen on my way back and just dump that there, and there's no washing up of any glasses. I'm recording in the sitting room today. I have a proper non-dregs bottle. It's actually cold. It can be taken from the fridge, and I have a clean glass as well. Oh, it's like living in Donald Trump land. You have a clean glass on demand. I didn't demand it from anyone. I got it myself. It's luxurious though. I'm luxuriating in proper pour the Coke in the glass from the bottle. It is getting down to the dregs now in the bottle, now that you mention it. I'm going to drink the dregs from the glass. Fucker, I'm going to drink the dregs from the glass, and then I'm going to put the glass in the dishwasher. And then when I start a new bottle, I'm going to start a new glass. Treat myself like a human being for once. That's what I'll do. Fucker. We'll go nuts and drink out of a drinking glass. Proper beverageware. Well, can you call it proper beverageware? I suppose you can. It's a Coke glass. I don't mean it's a Coca-Cola branded glass. No. It might as well be, though. Completely clear container made of glass. Basically a joint window into whatever's in there. And whatever's in there is Coca-Cola Zero. You can see it through the glass. I suppose in a way it is a Coke glass. It's a glass that I use for Coke. So there's that. If you're listening to this from inside an inflatable rubber car, not the type that has inflatable rubber tires on it. An inflatable rubber car. And I don't mean, I don't know what I don't mean, because I don't know what I do mean. I neither know what I mean or know what I don't mean. Because I haven't made it up yet. So that doesn't reflect badly on me. I have an open mind and an imagination, and I'm about to say what an inflatable rubber car is. I'm also about to decide what an inflatable rubber car is and pluck it from my active imagination that is being filled up with caffeine and drugs and taurine. I say caffeine and drugs and taurine. It's not really drugs. Caffeine is a drug, supposedly. And if you think caffeine is a drug, you probably think whatever is in energy drinks is a drug. And you probably think it's causing him to think there's this rubber thing that's an inflatable car. And he thinks, well, it could be. How about it's like a toy rubber inflatable? Children have rubber inflatable things, don't they? You have rubber ducks. So I presume as well you can have a rubber toy car. Or a rubber toy duck, or a rubber real duck, or a replica of a toy car. Either of those items presumably can be recreated in the same medium of which rubber ducks are a creation. Wait, are rubber ducks inflatable? I don't know. Let's say they are. Well, let's say a rubber inflatable duck is the same thing I'm talking about. When I'm talking about rubber inflatable cars, if you can have a rubber inflatable duck, you can also have a rubber inflatable car, and you can have a rubber inflatable toy car. Now, what's the difference? Well, they're very similar.
So you made the cat out of papier-mâché and you made a dog out of papier-mâché, they'd be very similar. And in the same way, if you made a duck out of inflatable rubber and you made a car out of inflatable rubber and you made a toy car out of inflatable rubber, if I'll be fine, there's very little difference between the toy car and the car, both of which are being recreated in inflatable rubber. If you made a statue of a car and a statue of a toy car, they'd be very similar. Maybe you might think to be different sizes, different scales. Neither of them would work as a real car, obviously, because it's a statue. And the same is true of a rubber inflatable car. You can have a rubber inflatable car and a rubber inflatable toy car. And that's when you find equality. You bring everyone down to the same level with rubber inflatable things and statues. That's the great thing about statues. You can be some billionaire who's holding on to a fistful of dollars in his hand, and a statue of that is exactly the same as a statue of some poor kid who's playing Monopoly and has a fistful of Monopoly dollars in its hand. Neither of which are real. It's all just rock. It's all just rock. All came from the same place. It was all carved out of some rock somewhere. You've carved several of your more sellable presidents into some mountain somewhere. You got this mountain. What was it called? Mount something, isn't it? You have a mountain somewhere called Mount Something. Now, we see it usually in cartoons. We see it in things like The Simpsons in cartoon form. So really, we're seeing a cartoon recreation of this mountain. We're not seeing the real thing at all. But if we saw the real thing, it would still just be a carve out of the presidents. It wouldn't be the presidents. Now, people like to say cartoons are for children. They're not real. But I think you'll find, I show you a cartoon image of that mountain and I show you the real mountain. Neither of those contain real presidents of the United States of America or any other republic. And the same is true of rubber ducks, rubber toy cars and rubber real cars. They're all the same thing. It's all the same now. It'll be all the same in 100 years when they're all dead and buried and gone to America, as a parent of mine used to say. I think she used to say that maybe 30 years ago when we were quite young. She used to say, it'll be all the same in 100 years, it'll be all dead and buried and gone to America. Now, she had already been to America at this point. She'd in fact lived in America for a while. She'd had her America phase, came home, settled down, had us, namely her children. And she was going around saying, it'll be all the same in 100 years, we're all dead and buried and gone to America. Later on, my brother emigrated to America and is still there. So she was predicting that one of her children at least would be gone to America, which she was accurate about. Hopefully she wasn't predicting that the rest of her children would be all dead and buried. Hopefully not. Hopefully not. My generation will be dead and buried. You'll be all gone to America. Well, except him. He'll stay here and make podcasts. You can't expect her to predict everything, every facet, every moment of our lives. Nor was she claiming to be fair. I don't think she even coined that phrase. I think she was repeating it from somewhere. It's like when you say a stitch in time saves 9. If you hear one of your parents saying that, they say a stitch in time saves 9, and you look into it, you think, oh, that's very wise and correct. A stitch in time does indeed save 9, whatever that means. You'll find out what it means, and presumably you'll find out it's meaningful. Well, that doesn't mean your parents came up with that phrase. No, they heard it somewhere. They picked it up somewhere. There's a very good chance that when they picked it up, they had no idea what it meant. They just started repeating it. They said, oh, that sounds wise and clever. But it turns out it was correct. Now, you're probably thinking, no, my parents came up with that independently. They said, a stitch in time saves 9. It was a general purpose piece of wisdom, and they were right. That's the important thing. They were right. No, it was accurate, but your parents didn't look into it and test it. They didn't go into some lab with pipettes and burettes and dry ice with goggles on them doing scientific tests or even have clipboards. No, they just picked it up. They were attracted to this phrase because it was memorable and sounded wise. It doesn't mean it was accurate. It probably was accurate, but they didn't know that.
I suppose that's not an unreasonable way to pass on knowledge. If you're passing on knowledge from generation to generation and you have a generation who are not scientists, but you know that these things, intelligence can skip a generation. It's a bit like alcoholism. Alcoholism and things like that often skip a generation. I think the idea is somebody experiences their parents being alcoholics and they decide, no, I'm not having that. I'm just dedicate my whole life to avoiding that. And it skips a generation. The next generation doesn't really know about it and forgets. Well, the same can be true of intelligence. Intelligence can skip a generation, or knowledge can skip a generation. So you might have great-great-grandparents who figured out how a stitch in time saves nine, and they've done the work in the laboratories or wherever. I'm not saying necessarily this was a chemistry thing that you do with pipettes and purettes. They did it in whatever branch of science or sociology or study it is. It may not have been in a lab at all. It may have been in some office where they're looking at figures or something, or they're doing population studies, whatever it's involved. They did the work. Someone at some point did the work, but they thought, wait, the next generation, they're not really that great. I think this whole knack for studying these figures and doing the numbers is going to skip their generation. So I'll turn it into a poetic thing that I can pass on to them. Kind of package it up in a little wrapper that'll make it poetic and memorable. They remember things using mnemonics and things like that. I might go, for example, 30 days has September, April, June and November, all the rest of 31 except February alone, which is 28 days clear and 29 in each leap year, obviously. Now, every second generation perhaps may well understand that intuitively because they know maths and they know logic and they know it all makes sense to them, but they'll have kids who it might not make sense to, but who are capable of memorizing a nice bit of poetry, and they'll do that. And that's how it gets passed on. That's how it gets passed on. So that's how Mother Nature manages to pass stuff on, even if your children are morons. And you live in hope that their children will turn out not morons, and that'll be great. That'll be great for you. It'll be great for them, and it'll be great for you, because you'll live on in some form. And that's a real poem, by the way, that I said there. The 30 days hath September, April, June and November, all the rest of 31 except February alone, which is 28 days clear and 29 in each leap year. That's accurate, but someone sat down and wrote that, so it is in itself art. At least you're passing on a bit of their culture. Even if they don't understand the science of it or the maths or the calendar, you're passing on a bit of culture. Now, of course, depending on their various different generations of different specialities, you might get someone who's a poet and they appreciate it for its poetry. You might have someone else who's into, I don't know, theological history, and he'll appreciate the whole Gregorian calendar history element of it. Be someone else who appreciates maths and time and physics and all that, and you say, oh, this is great. It's a nice little poem for remembering all this stuff about space. That's great. So different people appreciate different things about that. That's why it survived through so much. That poem has survived centuries and centuries of shit. It survived plague and famine and death and murder and Hades Comet and everything else. The only thing that poem will not survive would be anything that changes the lengths of the years. For example, if something moves the Earth out of its current orbit of the Sun, or the Sun gets destroyed, or something happens that changes the arc of the planets and how they go around, that would be problematic. The poem would become useless then, so there'd be no point remembering it. It'd be a bad thing then that you've made it memorable. You'd have your kids going around on this barren wasteland when nuclear fallout, and they're going around reciting this poem trying to find some practical use for it because they think it's going to help them in some way. It's not going to help them at all. They follow this poem, they're going to wake up someday and it's going to be the middle of summer, and their calendar that they've remembered in the poem will be telling them it's not only the middle of winter but it's the middle of the night, and be completely confused. It'll be completely useless to them. That's the only thing you have to worry about there. If you're listening to this from behind closed eyelids, or eyelids which you assume to be closed and which you assume to be eyelids, because you've just woken up, you've been asleep for several hours, you haven't opened your eyes yet, because Christ, who would want to? Who would want to in this world in 2025? Or, I know, you can call it 2025 now. We're not in the 2000s anymore. We can do the old-fashioned thing of saying 2025, like we used to do with 1925. You don't have to go 2025. Just to sound interesting today, I'm going to go 2025. I'm not going to do that thing you Americans do, by the way, where you go 2025. That's not a thing. It's 2025. Just as you scientists or mathematicians, you'll say 2 to the 9, when what you mean is 2 to the power of 9, because you can't be arsed to say a few extra words. It's 2 to the power of 9. It's not 2 to the 9. If you were an English professor and you said 2 to the 9, people would say, what in the name of Christ are you saying? You went to school, presumably. You learned basic grammar and English. And now you're going 2 to the 9. Have you no shame? May the Lord God Jesus Christ forgive you for your, whatever it is, that thing. Is it called? I don't know what you call it. It's probably some sin, is it? You'd know that too if you went to school. When you went to school, I know you're a maths genius now. You're a professor of maths. But you did go to school at some point before you went into all this university thing where you become a professor specializing in maths and numbers and never having to think about anything else. There was a time when you spent at least 12, 13 years going to school every day for 8, 9 months of the year. You went to various lessons and they weren't all maths. You did a whole wide selection of subjects. You did maths, I'm sure, but you also did geography. You did English. In this country, you may have done religion. You may have done business organization. What else might you have done? You might have done French or Spanish or geography or PE or music or technical drawing, all sorts of other things. You didn't spend your whole day thinking about maths. You did not. And when you were doing that, if you had come along during your English class and said, oh, I'm just going to go 8 to the 5. Why not 8 to the 5? Like you're doing some sort of rap thing. 2 to the or, P to the N, 8 to the 5. No, say it properly. So I don't mean to make a whole about English speaking. There's a very high chance you did Irish. Quite a high chance you also did French or Spanish or German. And in those classes, I've no way of knowing because I don't speak those languages. But I'm quite sure you didn't stand up in those classes and say, oh, Muntor, Tommy, studying Irish. How do I say 8 to the 5 in Irish? The Irish teacher, of course, will say, ask it os Gaelge, meaning ask it in Irish. And you say, you want me to ask, how do I say 8 to the 5 in Irish? In Irish. And the Irish teacher will say, of course, oh, you have a point there. Ta pointa a gush. Ta to have pointa. I'll tell you what we'll do. Go in next door to the French class and ask him in Irish, how do you say 8 to the 5 in French? We'll see how that works out for you. And of course you will say to that, you'll say, why would we do that? And you'll say, don't question your teacher. Go in and question the teacher next door. Ask him, how do you say 8 to the 5 in French? I suppose you can't really have all these cross-pollination of language classes until you've been studying them for a few years at least. The French and German classes, they don't get going until we're 12 or 13. So we're not going to be sophisticated enough in French or German or Spanish to be able to go into each class and say, hello, my teacher just sent me in to ask, because he's a smart heart. He sent me in here to ask, how do I say 8 to the 5 in whatever language this is? That would be more sensible to tell him. Go into the maths class next door and ask, how do you say 8 to the 5 in English? The maths teacher will probably send a note back to the
Ivor's seat are saying, what's this about? Is this some sort of weird punishment you're sending him into me for? And what am I being punished for? Or what is the people being punished for? And under what authority? Because you're not a particularly senior teacher here. I'm 85. I've been the maths teacher here for 60 years. And you're some young fella coming in here with your Irish notes. And because one of my students happens to have an aptitude for maths, and he has the temerity to say some numbers like 8 to the 5, you have the temerity to send him in here with some smart ass question about how do you say 8 to the power 5 in math. Well, how you say it in maths is 8 to the 5. Maybe in English you say 8 to the power of 5. But in maths we say 8 to the 5 because, well, we like to create the impression that we're so intelligent and brainy that we become a bit absent-minded. We're like absent-minded professors. It's a branding thing. We like to brand ourselves as absent-minded professors. So we go 8 to the 5 and we forget to say 8 to the power of 5. Rest assured, we haven't forgotten to say it. We're just saying 8 to the 5 as a branding thing. Just as when you're saying stuff in Irish, you probably brand yourself. You say stuff like, oh, I don't know. You say stuff in Irish. That's a brand in itself. Well, we say stuff in maths. We say 8 to the 5 instead of 8 to the power of 5, and it suits us fine. Go in and question the teacher next door, religion class. Have you ever died saying 8 to the 5 instead of 8 to the power of 5? See how that works out. I would argue that you're more likely to die while saying 8 to the power of 5 because that takes longer, there's more time for you to die. Not to say that you're going to hold off your death because of that. I'm just saying the chances of you dying while saying 8 to the 5 are smaller than the chances of you dying while saying 8 to the power of 5. Simply because there's less time covered, all other things being equal. You're not taking into account how fast you're saying it, so that could all be nonsense then, or it could be made to be nonsense. So I suppose there's that.
Into your head!
Anyway, you've just opened your eyes. And that's actually quite likely. If you're listening to a podcast, there's a good chance you've just opened your eyes. You fell asleep with your earphones in. You've opened your eyes, but not your eyelids. So you've activated your eyes, perhaps, but not your eyelids. Or you haven't really activated them. You just know that they're available. You've woken up, is what I'm saying, but you're not opening your eyelids yet. Because one thing at a time, for Christ's sake. You think, oh Christ, it's still here. It's still here. Let's see. One thing at a time. We'll take off one layer of bandages at a time. I'm here and I'm alive and I'm awake and there's a, oh Christ. So my eyes are closed. You're kind of on autopilot when you wake up. So you activate your eyes, but you have the presence of mind not to open your eyelids. You think, oh wait, I can't see anything. Oh, that's because my eyes are still closed. And I think I like that they're still closed. So now that I'm kind of wakening up and I'm alert, I'm aware that my eyelids are still closed. So I'm going to keep them closed for a few minutes. Because fuck this shit, one thing at a time. So I won't worry about the fact that I can't see anything, even though my eyes are activated, because I know my eyelids are still closed. So that's great. Now, I was wearing earphones when I went to sleep because I was listening to some crap. And let me see, there's a play pause button on my earphones here. I'll press that and this podcast will come on possibly. So that's why I say there's a good chance that you're in bed with your eyes closed. So if that's you, hello, good morning, how are you today? Well, I suppose you're still finding out. You're still assessing how you are today. You're still assessing that. You're thinking, wait, I'm alive. I made it through another night. That's either good or not good. I don't know. You're still assessing that. You're having your little self-diagnosis. You're going, hey, a minute, how am I? Well, my neck is sore because I fell asleep in a stupid position with these stupid pillows that are too comfortable and therefore uncomfortable when I wake up because they're not really supposed to sleep on them. They fucked me up.
I've problems with pillows lately. I can't figure out where you're supposed to be comfortable when you go to sleep or not comfortable. Because when I'm comfortable when I go to sleep, I wake up with my neck twisted in knots, like something a Boy Scout would be proud of. Not a girl guide, because according to you Americans anyway, in your situation comedies, your girl guides are they different from Girl Scouts? I'm not sure. But your girl guides go around cooking, making cookies all day. They don't tie knots. Boy Scouts do a lot of learning how to tie knots, how to do the type of knot that you put on your shoe, the type of knot that you use to attach a boat to the... You need a knot for that. You don't really. I was on a boat once. I spent a week on the River Shannon. Didn't need to tie any knots for that. He didn't really. There was a rope involved. He got into park somewhere. He went into the car park, the boating car park or harbour, wherever you called it. He'd have this rope thing and you throw it over a little bar thing on the pier. You're not really tying it. You pull it around in a figure of eight and then you... I have a loop tied in the end of it already. You're not really tying run tie. It's like what the young people do with their shoes now. They keep them tied or they keep them untied, whatever horrific configuration you have on them. They leave it like that now. They just put their shoes on and off like that. Well, it's like that with the boats, and it always has been, except, of course, for the Sea Scouts. They think, no, you have to untie. I bet you they do anyway. I've never been in the Sea Scouts. I did almost join the Sea Scouts once. There was a friend of mine who was in the Sea Scouts. He said, oh, you should join the Sea Scouts. I said, oh, should I? How should I do that? And he said, well, one way you could do it would be to come down to the Sea Scouts with me and meet the Sea Scout master. I'm a member of the Sea Scouts, so I could bring you down with me and you could meet him. And I did that. I don't think that anything came of it. Thankfully, I don't think I'd want to be in the Sea Scouts. I did live by the sea at the time. I lived on a mountain beside the sea in Bray for several years as a teenager. And there was Sea Scouts available at the opposite end of the sea. I don't mean the other side of the sea. I mean the opposite end of the seafront. If I walk about a mile to get to this harbour, and then what? You get in some boat or something. There was a kid up the road, literally on a mountain. There were houses up in the mountain. He could drive up. It was very steep. There was literally kids up there whose father was building a boat in their driveway for 11 years. They literally, when he finally finished building it, he named it Festine Lente, which I understand means hasten slowly. Then one day a crane came up and they lifted the boat out. We all watched it. This boat finally being towed down to the harbour a mile away. And I think what happened then was that he sold it and got another boat, and that was his boat then. So that's great. Well done. You have a boat. Well done. You got yourself a boat and now you got rid of it and now you finally have your driveway back. What are you going to do now? Get a car? His driveway was full of boats for at least a decade. We were all watching this boat being built in his front garden. Spent all his spare time working on this boat. I don't know if he lived in the boat. It had a cabin of some sort. His front garden was literally all boat for 10 years and then it was gone because the boat was down in the harbour. Then the boat was gone. And then what? You have a garden that you haven't been working on. You have a garden that you haven't been even been rotating. Unless he was planting stuff under the boat while he was building it. Maybe he had a system whereby he didn't build the floor of the boat until near the end. So for years and years, he had it so that the boat doubled as a greenhouse. So he grew stuff under it in the driveway. That seems unlikely. It was a driveway after all. People don't normally put vegetable patches at the front of their house. Now, that was a steep hill. To grow anything on that was quite a miracle. My father managed to grow vegetables on that hill, which I believe I've told you about before. He built a turret to make it slightly less hilly. You know what's involved in growing stuff. You don't need me to go down that road again. Anyway, that's Sea Scouts for you. Oh yes, the knots. I was talking about the knots. I presume the Sea Scouts take knots more seriously than most people.
people who are just tying shoelaces or people who are just... Does anyone really use nuts nowadays? I don't know. We have smartphones. We probably don't use nuts as much as we used to. Unless I'm going out, I don't tie them. You don't need to tie a knot to plug your phone in, do you? No, you're just connecting one thing to another. You're kind of plugging it in. There's no knots involved in that. In the old days when you used to plug stuff in, was there knots involved in that? I don't think so. I don't think there was ever any knots involved in plugging electrical components into other electrical components. And nowadays, of course, I have a wireless charger for my phone. I find I break plugs and sockets a lot less. But I also find that a wireless charger can be fucking annoying. But attach the wireless thing to your phone, charges for a few minutes, and then it says, I'm full. It'd be like if a child came up to you. You fed your child. Ignore the bit where I said if a child came up to you. Assuming you have a child and you feed it. And then you wait a few days and the child's system has decided, oh, I'm full now, don't need to do anything else now, don't need to eat ever again unless I'm actively unplugged and then plugged back in. So that's how my wireless charger seems to work, at least the one in the bedroom. So that's a bit ridiculous. You feed up your child and you say, oh, I'm great now, I'm all fed, I'll go off to school. And then a few days later, you find it's died of starvation because it hasn't eaten anything since. Well, that's exactly what the one I use in the bedroom and with. That's exactly how it seems to work. But I'm aware of it now. So after it has its breakfast and it's full up, I unplug it and then plug it back in and then it'll be feeding itself. It'll be like on a drip, except keeping you completely full. Does a drip keep you completely full, I wonder? If you're on a feeding drip, does it keep you completely full? Or does it say, oh, I want him to still experience what it's like to be hungry for a while and work up an appetite? I wonder, say you're in a coma for a few years. So to decide, oh, it's feeding time now. This is dinner time. Do they give you an appetizer first? They just give you a little jab of whatever it is they give you and think, oh, that will give him an appetite. And then his body will kind of half wake up and think, oh, I want more. Or they just give you a constant drip. They just keep you constantly like you're in some wacky future where everyone's on food pills and you don't have to think about things anymore. You don't have to think about eating anymore. Except you can't think about eating anymore because you're in a coma. So I suppose you have the best and worst of that world at the same time. That's probably not ideal. Once upon a time, there was a dog. A dog. A dog, 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 basically a dog. Now we're being informed by approximately one listener. I'm not entirely sure if they're saying it out loud or in their mind. But they're going around at some point during the day because of me. They're thinking the word dog in that format. They're thinking dog instead of whatever a supposedly normal person says or thinks. Normal people are going around, they're thinking the word dog in their mind because part of their day involves thinking the word dog. There's nothing weird about that, just like anyone else. When you go about your day, there are words that are involved in your day. It might be, for example, printer, train, child, Unilever, cottage pie, cottage cheese, whatever's involved in your day. There are words that come up in your day, and for quite a lot of people, the words that come up during their day include the word dog, either saying it or thinking it. At the very least, if you're with a dog, you're going to be thinking the word dog. If you're with other people or you're addressing the dog, you might be saying the word dog. At the very least, you're thinking it. I think if people are inspired by me to think the word dog in the manner of going, a dog, a dog, a dog, I think most likely they're doing it in their mind, not out loud. Or else they're on their own at home and they're just going around going, dog, dog, dog to themselves.
I wonder are they going, because I'm usually going, a dog. Once upon a time, there was a dog, a dog. If you're with a dog, you're addressing the dog. So you address them as dog. You wouldn't say, hello, a dog. It sounds less weird when you can't see the way I'm pointing at the microphone every time I say a dog here while I'm doing this right now. I don't usually do it that way. I'm going, once upon a time there was a dog, a dog, a dog. But I find myself when I'm doing it now, I'm thinking about the fella who's there somewhere addressing his dog as a dog, going, you're a dog, a dog, a dog. And if I'm saying that, I'm pointing, I'm prodding my finger over towards the general direction of my kitchen over there, which is just beyond the glass door. I wasn't pointing at anything in particular or concentrating on where I was pointing. But I see now the general direction I was pointing at is the bottom half of the fridge freezer, which in this country, being a normal country, the bottom half of our fridge freezers are the freezer compartment. There isn't a load of other shit. We don't have all these ice taps and electric heater attachments and whatever else you have on your American fridge freezers. No, just the fridge freezer. Top half is the fridge. You have that at eye level and waist level. And the bottom half is the part that you go to every couple of days. You bring along a bucket. When you want to access the freezer part of your fridge freezer, I bring a chair with me. I sit in front of the fridge freezer. I open up the drawers. And I have a kind of a bucket, or usually something like an old, quite deep metal baking tray as my little shopping trolley. I'm not shopping, I'm exploring my freezer for things to take out and defrost. So I'll go in and I'll say, oh, what's that? That looks like a bag of minced beef. I think we'll have bolognese tomorrow. Assuming this turns out to be what I think it is. Frankly, it could be anything. So that's what you do with the bottom half. The top half of the fridge freezer, that's the refrigerator. We put milk in our fridge. The milk door of a fridge. People get fooled by this. They think, oh, that's like just leaving it at the door. That's like just barely entering the fridge at all. No, once you close that fridge door, it's a whole different world there. That's what we forget. I'm guilty of this myself. I forget that in a moment when that fridge door is closed, it's going to be a whole different world. It's not going to look anything like the layout or configuration that I had while it was open. And most of the time, it's not open. It's only open so I can access it. You forget that. You think, oh, I'll put this in the fridge door. Hopefully, it'll get a bit of refrigeration, even though it's not even in the fridge at all. I know, when you close the door, it is in the fridge. It's part of the fridge. In fact, it's a vital part of the fridge because it closes out the outside world for most of the time. You just never get to see it do that. You never get to see it do that. It's like trying to see the inside of your own eyelids. It just can't be done. You can't see the inside of your own eyelids. Try it now. Close your eyes. See if you can see the inside of your own eyelids. And no, you can't. You see nothing. You've closed your eyes so they're deactivated so you can't see anything. You might be thinking, oh, look, I can see blackness. That's the inside of my eyelid. No, it's not. That's just blackness. That's like when you turn your TV off and there's still a black screen. That's not, you're not seeing anything. Your eyes are deactivated. So don't be fooling yourself with that bullshit. If you think I'm incorrect about that, I'm vision impaired. I know all about not being able to see stuff sometimes. So I know that when I close my eyes, turn back the curtain to see for certain what we can see. Far, far away, light is dimming, the world is something, and something, something, any dream will do, any dream will do. That's the, what you call it, that's James and the Giant Technicolor Dream Coat. The Andrew Lloyd Webber musical has a song from that. Not about a fridge, but it's very good. Oh, this isn't it, incidentally. This is just, I happen to have my sitting room harmonica here that I got last year. I haven't really got much use out of it, surprisingly. Maybe I'll swap this with the one that's in the spare bedroom and then we'll get more use out of this. Superior harmonica certainly has a different sound to it.
we deserve to hear more out of it. I'm so desperate to use it, I have it right there in my hand as I'm running through the James and the Technicolor Dreamcoat thing. I already had this in my hand. Wasn't even appropriate, because it's not even a harmonica song. And I wasn't playing the song, I was reciting the words from it. But no, I'm forcing myself now. I'm so desperate to have a go on this harmonica. That's a bit sad, isn't it? If you ever have an opportunity to ride a bicycle built for two, but to incorrect specifications, perhaps unintentionally built for two, yeah, set the plans for a bike and behave just like a computer. You feed these plans into yourself and you just follow the plans and not think about what you're building, and you'll come out with a bicycle built for two. I presume builders do that. You're building a house. Someone sends you the plans for a row of houses. You don't look at them and you say, oh, this is going to be a row of houses. You just follow the plans, and the plans are like self-assembly flat pack furniture. You get these plans, you look at the first thing, it says lay out all the stuff, lay out all the bricks on the ground in this order, in this shape. One row of bricks, and then it tells you put another row of bricks, kind of overlap them, and then make this stuff that's a bit like paste and put it in between the bricks. Now we say in between the bricks, don't leave any gaps between the bricks, but nonetheless put this stuff in the gaps between the bricks anyway. Somehow, or put it somewhere. I don't know where. If you're laying the bricks properly, there should be nowhere to put this paste. So I don't know how that's going to work. So think of it as an invisible glue. The hockey boys, no space whatsoever, but still needs to be there. So you have your bricks perfectly lined up with no gaps or spaces between them. And you just put this glue in between them. It's a glue that takes up zero space, as a total area of 0.00001 cubic centimeter. So you slosh this on between the bricks and that holds them together. I don't know how to do that. I know you can make invisible glue, but surely you can't make glue that takes up no space whatsoever. And in order to use glue that takes up at least some space, even if it's minimum, you would have to have some imperfections between the bricks for some space into which to put this glue. I don't know, maybe they don't use glue. I was led to believe by my thoughts and by my understanding. I thought there was stuff that sticks walls together. The bricks are stuck together with something. And it's not just stuck together by painting the glue onto the outside surface. No, it has to be between the bricks somehow. Now, I know we have, particularly in the west of Ireland, we have these stone walls put together without glue and the bricks are just arranged. You get these stones of all different shapes and sizes and they arrange them. They make these walls that stay structurally sound for hundreds of years. Oh, it looks slapped together in a haphazardy form. They're just held together by weight, ironically. But there'll be plenty of spaces to put glue in there, or at least some plaster or whatever you put. But no, they don't do that. So that's a bit weird, isn't it? Maybe it isn't. I'm sure if you're a builder or you're a glue person or an architect, you think, no, this is perfectly normal. He's talking nonsense. Well, that's okay. I trust that you know what you're doing if you work in those regions. So you please trust that you know what I'm doing when I work in the region of saying stuff. Let's just live and let live, shall we? Just live and let live. You're building walls that could fall down on anyone at any moment, but they don't, because they're apparently so well built. Meanwhile, your descendants are building walls that the bricks are so well put together that there's not a single gap between them, but as a result, there's nowhere to put glue. So they're going to collapse in a heap because everything will just slide off. In your world, maybe that makes sense. These bricks are so smooth, you can't make any gaps between them, but you somehow find somewhere to put glue. I don't know. And you don't know either, so don't tell me you know. You're probably some architect. Your skill as an architect is to create the impression that you know stuff and that you're conveying it to other people. So you draw pictures. You say, here's a picture of what I want to be done on this area of space.
and you're to follow these. I'm going to come along and inspect there every couple of weeks and make sure that what you're doing matches at least one stage of the pictures in this plan, and then I'll be happy. Make sure it doesn't fall down, that's what you say. They're going by the plan, surely it won't fall down. Have you put anything in the plan saying it should be able to fall down? Unless you've done that, then it won't fall down, so don't worry. If these people are following your plans, and your plans don't say anything about making it fall down, you just say, no, make it properly, don't make it fall down. You shouldn't have to state that. If it's a proper plan and they just follow the plan, you don't need to specifically stipulate that it shouldn't fall down. Just follow the plans. This plan is for a thing that doesn't fall down. If you follow the plan, it won't fall down unless you're incompetent. That's what you imply in your pictures that you draw. I'm beginning to think I don't understand how architecture works at all, or building. I'm not sure it does. Look, I don't know. They built the pyramids thousands of years ago. They got these ropes and they got these bricks. Bricks nowadays, you get a concrete block, it has two holes in it, kind of a hollow on the inside, some of these bricks. You can put a rope to the bricks, and instead of building the skeleton structure of a building out of iron, here's what you do. I have to make clear that you know what I'm talking about before I proceed with this idea. Instead of using solid bricks, you're using those big concrete blocks. Each concrete block, it's not completely filled, there's a square hole in it. So if you stick those bricks on top of each other, instead of having them overlap like you're building a wall where the end of each brick meets the end of the other brick and then the brick on top of that goes over that join. No, just put each concrete block directly on top of another concrete block. Then you can put a rope through those square holes. You put a weight on it. You'd have to build it so that you can access. That's what you do. Leave a little gap at the bottom of this wall. Just leave a gap in the floorboards or something. Just until you can do this. Because you're going to have to get a piece of rope, attach a weight like a stone, and then put that down through the bricks. Right down to the bottom. Because all these bricks are stacked one directly on top of the other. So this rope can be lowered through the hollow in the center of these bricks till it gets right down to the bottom. Then at the bottom, you pull the rope out. You can get rid of the weight. That's just to get the rope down to the bottom. Then you can pull the rope out. So you have the end of the piece of rope coming out of the bottom of the wall. And then what? I suppose you can put it up to the next brick stack beside that. Now, how would you... I suppose you put another bit of rope down to the next stack of bricks and then tie them together, I suppose. Oh, whatever way you do it, either way, you end up where you have a rope threaded through all these bricks. And that'd be a lot better than trying to stick them together with glue. Wouldn't it? Makes it easy to disassemble as well. It'd be handy to be able to disassemble a brick building. The historic town hall in Bray, County Wicklow, is 200 or 300 years old. It's a nice red brick building. It's an old historic town hall. It stopped being in use as a town hall, so some American was going to buy it and bring it brick by brick over to America somehow. That plan didn't go through, so it became a restaurant. Restaurant didn't do very well. But eventually it got turned into a McDonald's, and it's still there. So they still have the historic town hall. There's a big M somewhere inside it, but not too many M's on the outside. Everyone knows what it is. They say, oh, that's the M place. I know there's not a lot of signage on it, but they all know it's the M place. And they built a new building beside it in a similar style. It's just a little row of shops, but they made it to match the historic building. And that leads me to believe that if they had sold off the historic building, they could have just built a new one, made a profit. Presumably the new one would have been made more cheaply. They could have sold off the historic town hall and just built a new one, the exact same except cleaner looking and more modern. Which you would have to do anyway if you're going to restore it and clean it up, so why not just sell that off and build a new one? That's like being able to sell a copy of yourself and keep the new copy. We're told that every 10 years all our cells replace themselves or something and you have a whole new body. If you could sell off the old body,
collect your old skin or something until you have enough to make a whole old version of you. Wouldn't be a fully working version of you, but we'd have all the bricks that could be reassembled somewhere, send them off to be harvested somehow. Would that not be desirable? I think that would be desirable. Certainly a lot more desirable than turning it into a McDonald's. Anyway, if you do ever have an opportunity to ride a bicycle, good for two, but whatever I said, what did I say? Some nonsense about it being built using the instructions for a tricycle. Can you have a tricycle built for two? You probably can. I suppose maybe if one of them is pregnant, perhaps. Pregnant with expectations from this tricycle ride going out on some date. He said, oh, hello. Would you like to come out on a bicycle ride with me on a tricycle built for two? Of course, that conjures up all sorts of images. You think, wait, that sounds like it could be quite fantastic. One of the early classic Muppet movies had Muppets on bicycles. I don't know if they were on tandems, but there were bicycles involved. And no one really took much note of what type of bicycle were involved because they were so enthralled by the mechanics of how they had these puppets operating. You could see Kermit's feet. You could see all the Muppets' feet and their hands. They actually seemed to be riding these bicycles. I don't even remember. For all I know, it was so distracting. He didn't even notice. Were they on tricycles? Were they on tandems? Did they each have their own individual bicycle? Were some of them mopeds? I think we'd have noticed that. We'd have been less enthralled by the mopeds because on a moped, you just sit on it, you operate it with your hands and your feet are just sitting there on a platform. They're not on the ground, they're not operating pedals or anything like that. So no, you'd have been less enthralled by that, so you'd have been more attentive. So you'd have been able to see, wait a minute, that's just probably Miss Piggy on a moped, is it? You'd probably have noticed whether or not she was wearing a helmet. And you'd understand if she wasn't, because helmets are not made to standards like that whereby they fit different animals. Or I know a Muppet isn't an animal. If you're born into the Muppet race, you can end up being a frog or a pig or anything else and still be a Muppet. It makes no sense whatsoever. Now, the Sesame Street was a... I don't know much about American streets, so I have no idea whether it's realistic or not. I do know every Thursday when they come along with their road sweeping device, if you have a car there, they're going to put a 10 million euro fine on it. Just stay on the road in a holding pattern while we clean the streets. Don't leave anything lying around on the street. Did they fine children for leaving their balls and tricycles out on the footpath on those nights? I don't know. I presume there were areas where there was nowhere to put your car because you can't just empty every car in that street into another nearby street that's not getting cleaned that night. There's only so much space in the city. So I presume there were people who had to spend the whole night out driving their cars in a, like an airport that has to shut down for a while because of bad weather. Some planes have to kind of go around in a holding pattern. If they're running out of fuel, they can declare an emergency and then they let them land somewhere. Or if you're not in an emergency, you can't go around saying, oh yes, it's an emergency. My street is getting swept tonight. So I'm in a holding pattern, but I don't have enough petrol because for some reason I didn't get petrol despite knowing that every single Thursday night of my life I have to do this. I have to get out of the house and drive my car around in a holding pattern while my street is swept. Anyway, they do that. That's why America has so many roads. Everyone is going around in a holding pattern for one night a week. Even if they barely drive at all the rest of the week, they have a whole night that they spend out driving. It's different people every night, so at least there's that. At least everyone isn't having to drive 7 nights a week. No. They take turns. I presume if you're in a couple and it's every Thursday, one person takes one Thursday and the other one takes the next Thursday and they take turns sleeping. It's almost like having a job, except you're not paid. You avoid a fine by doing this. So I suppose the privileged among you in America can afford to occasionally go, oh, I can't be arsed driving round in a holding pattern round the city all night this Thursday. I'm going to just keep my car there and swallow the fine, whatever it is they can fine me, fuck it. So I suppose that happens. That's why you have a massive national debt.
But it doesn't bother you, so that's good.
So well done, America, that's good. That's good. Anyway, that seems like it's the end. I think that's the end of the programme.